It's comforting to be here together tonight. Calm, serene for a moment or two. Anything on your minds tonight you want to talk about? Questions, comments?
You know, my background is much more in Vipassana than in Zen, and metta is a much more integral part of Vipassana. And I was wondering if that's part of Zen practice. I was thinking about it through the storm.
Loving kindness.
Yeah, sending loving kindness to people.
Yeah, it's very much part of Zen. You know, Zen is Mahayana, and Mahayana is Bodhisattva of compassion. So, yeah, Bodhisattva of compassion is loving kindness. Our true nature is empty of any sort of conception, perception. It's already clear. It's already compassion. It's already loving kindness without us having to make an effort. It's very subtle, our attachment to the senses, to the consciousness, to how we formulate what we see, hear, touch, taste in our minds, how we make something out of it. And yet we have such a need to make sense out of life and have it have purpose. And in all that effort that we put forth, we're kind of missing the boat. I was thinking again tonight about this bumper sticker that I had about don't believe everything you think. And there's a whole movement now to believe everything you think. The whole idea of being right is so important because people are truly fearful. And when you have no fear, you don't have a need to make sense of it. It already is. Fearlessness is acknowledging oneness. It's acknowledging the Tao. It's understanding that things are the way they are and not having to make something out of them. For me, loving kindness comes out of with every breath, with every visual exchange with someone. Without having to say it, mention it, or repeat it in my mind. It's just there. Because we're all part of that, you know, that oneness that is loving kindness. I mean, that's another way, just another way of describing something that's beyond description. So in Zen, we try not to describe things because it's beyond description. In Vipassana, you know, they're sort of divided up into two aspects of sitting, of meditating.
Yes, the first one's watching the breath and drawing a blank on what that's called, but yes.
Yeah. And in Zen, it already is. We don't separate samadhi or Vipassana. It's just a way, it's just another way of getting to the point.
Yes, I mean, definitely, basically it already is, but what I've experienced with metta practice is a heart-opening feeling, a heart-opening and a connection in a way that sometimes feels deeper and broader than simply sitting. It's like a doorway. Like a doorway to the heart opens, like Stephen Pine calls it, the heart we all share. It's because it's all the oneness, it's the heart we all share. So even though metta breaks it down, you know, where you're sending loving kindness to yourself and to other people, even people you have difficulty with, it opens the heart so you can feel that there is only one heart.
Yes. So that's a good practice. So there is a time in your practice where that's a good thing to be doing. I've done that.
Yeah.
But now I don't do that anymore. It's not a right or wrong. It's just there was a time, and I may resort back to it when I feel constricted, or I don't feel my heart is open, or I feel like I need to pay attention to someone in my life that I'm not paying attention to. And when I sit, I'll do that.
Right. For me, with the election coming, I think it will be very helpful.
Yeah. Well, I think there's some other storms in our future. It's just part of this human experience. You can't experience non-duality from duality.
Yes.
The thing that I offer from what I do is I try to provide a way for people to understand themselves so that they can awaken to something broader, bigger than what they think. Metta practice is the same thing. That's the intention. Is broaden your experience beyond your limited view of self.
Yes.
And my position is just drop self. And you've already got it.
Yes.
Yeah, but I'm not arguing with doing the practice at all, right? Yeah. I'm saying, sure.
I mean, even, you know, the night of the hurricane, I was working with mantra.
Yeah.
Stay calm.
Sure.
I mean, it helped a lot.
I do that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of it. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I have my own baggage. I have my own karma. I have my own propensities for certain kinds of fears or anxieties. And when I feel that happening, you know, I refer to it as feeling constricted.
Yeah.
Rather than definitely. My heart being open and, you know, I'll resort to mantra too. And sometimes I used to do the walking meditation with Om Noms.
The whole group?
I would do Om Noms the whole time we're walking.
Oh, okay.
Every time we walk, I do Om Noms the whole time. Nobody knows this, but now you know it. But recently I've been experimenting with not doing it. Because again, it becomes a habit.
Yeah.
It becomes something that you rely on that's not real. Mm-hmm. Once you rely on it, it is not something that's real, that really benefits you. It's a crutch.
But it's almost like, you know, the rituals that we have here, you know, ending with the four bodhisattva vows.
Yeah.
It's a similar thing. That's how we end. It becomes...
So I've always, you know, I would go and sit with the Zen master and we'd do all these little rituals and the four bodhisattva vows. And I think to myself, why are we doing this? And for a long time, I didn't understand. And it's like the mantras and it's like all these other practices. They have value and they have a use. And they can also be a crutch. And they can also tangle you up in something that is unreal. Just like a political view can. You know, the way you define your Buddhist practice can be a political belief. You know what I mean? It's like, are you really don't know and you're really open, or are you confining yourself to my practice? You know, so whenever I feel like I'm doing that, I try to drop it and see what's there. You know, and sometimes I come right back to it and go, oh no, I'm not, you know, I'm not attached to it. It's just useful right now. I'm using it as a upaya, as something to you know, help me along. So why not do it? Sure. I have no problem with that. It's just,
yeah, I see what you mean.
It's our attachments though.
And that's, you know, and that's why I love going on retreats, because on retreats, there's, you know, you're in this container and, yeah. And it just doesn't feel like that. Yeah. When you're dealing with hurricanes and other things like hurricanes. I mean, one of the reasons why I was drawn to loving kindness, I was telling Alice, is as the hurricane was approaching, I was realizing for the first time in my life, I may know people who lose their homes. I may know people who even lose their lives.
Yes.
Like Sarasota might not be anything like I knew it to be. And I've just led a very sheltered life. I have never experienced anything like that on a big scale.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, here's the thing about that.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this on Sunday a little bit in terms of karma. You know, and people feeling, wow, the tree fell on the neighbor's house, you know, and I'm really grateful it didn't fall on my house, you know, but there's also that sort of, now you're in the realm of duality and you're making a judgment. Oh, poor them. So we use this story that Michael brought up about the farmer who lost his horse, and the neighbor said, oh, that's terrible. You poor guy, you lost your horse. Maybe so, maybe not. I don't remember how Michael phrased it, but something like that. Maybe so, maybe not. Then the horse came back with another horse. Oh my God, you fortunate person. Now you have two horses. You know, well, maybe so, maybe not. Then, you know, the son goes to train the horse and falls off and breaks his leg. Oh, you poor guy, he broke his leg. You know, maybe so, maybe not. So we have to be really careful about our judgments, because that's in the realm of duality. And karma, we all have our own work to do. We all have our own experience. It's not the same. It can't be. Yet, you know, what you're given to work with, you're given to work with. It's what you have to work with. The neighbor is not you. They have something different to work with. And if their house blows away and yours doesn't, that's not on you. You see, can you have compassion? Of course. Can you help them? Of course. Can you ask the question, how can I help? Yeah, that's sort of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't take it on as, you know, you have to somehow make it okay. Because that's causes and conditions. If this happens, that happens. If you build a house on a barrier island,
yeah,
and then you're so obsessed with it that you refuse to leave and you lose your life, it's on you. I'm sorry. I'm not being dispassionate.
Right.
I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying you're being foolish. You may be, but I'm not judging. I'm just saying causes and conditions. And causes and conditions, I mean, we're all in this together. It's all one big experience. Everything is related. So we can't separate it out. And we're part of it. But we each have our unique position,
mm-hmm,
because of how we think, how we act, how we behave, how we've created our life up to this point, you know. And some things are just out of our control, just like storms or getting cancer. I mean, you know, you can't sit and feel guilty. I haven't led a good life. I've got bad karma. That's why I've got cancer. You know, I mean, all of that is duality. It's delusion. It's fooling yourself. It's not real. I mean, it sounds kind of like I'm being, you know, dispassionate or not caring, but it's not true.
Well, it comes back to the analogy that I use all the time of, it's like you live your life as if you're not in a movie, but you know, it's kind of like a movie.
Yeah.
Well, I think another part that's coming to me with what you just spoke about has to do with our feeling like if we don't have as terrible of an experience as our neighbor, then maybe we're supposed to, or maybe we're at fault for something.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like we don't deserve to understand our potential, our wholeness, our peace. There's always a reason for giving that away.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I certainly don't have that all figured out, but I think if I was in my total wholeness and peace, then I wouldn't see things as tragically as I see them now.
A lot of the tragedy, I mean, it's like, is it really tragedy or isn't it? Is something getting worked out on a scale that we don't understand? You know, whether it's an individual or as a group or as a society, as a world. I mean, what we're going through, don't judge, don't know. Don't make something out of it. That way you can deal with it as it comes and hopefully make decisions that are more clear and less based on that duality of positive, negative, dark, light. Because illumination is not the opposite of darkness, you see. The illumination we talk about is unaffected by the lightness and the darkness, the opposites. It's like the Tao, mm-hmm. like you mentioned.
Yeah.
But how do you explain this? Or how do you, you know, you can't, you have to live it. You have to like awaken to your own nature and then live in harmony with whatever's happening. And then make a choice based on what you need to do in the moment. And if you're living fearlessly, then you're not dominated by the fears. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's like having a bad dream or a nightmare that's not real, you know, based on the fears that you had during the day that are just kind of like you made up, or the uncertainty, you know. And so now all of a sudden, you know, in your mind, you're having to recreate it in some sort of monstrous experience, you know. So we have these monstrous experiences in our minds that are not based on anything that's actually happening. The water isn't actually up to our necks. For some people, it was. That's different. That's a reality of life and death present in the moment, different than our fears, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Our fears are usually not based on the actual experience. When you're in it, sometimes you don't have time to be afraid. You're just trying to survive it.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, fear is way ahead of that. I don't know. Yes, am I glad that things weren't worse for us than, I mean, they could have been so much worse. They could have been like they are in the South County for us here. It came very close to that. It's only 50 miles away.
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
The wind changed so suddenly. I remember thinking they were predicting, I think, 155 miles an hour. And then all of a sudden, it like switched.
Yeah.
Like 70 or 80.
But even the 70, 80, look at what it did in our
neck.
Trees, huge, big trees down. As I'm driving around, you know, at first, it's almost like my vision has gotten broader and I see more and more damaged property. And there are branches just hanging up in those trees that have already broken off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't want to walk under that. You know, that's one of the things. If you're a camper, when you go camping, you look up. Do I want to put my tent here? No, probably not. There's some dead branches up there, right? So it's the same thing. We're dealing with this now. So if you have a lot of trees in your neighborhood, you should probably look up before you walk under them. Well, I'm glad you were safe. The dog's fine too.
Yeah. Really,
yeah.
She was pretty terrified. When the rain and the wind were really loud, she was like looking around, and her ears were like periscopes on a submarine.
Oh yeah. So Buddha's, I think, essentially Buddha's teaching is don't know. It's a hard one. It's, you know, we can't comprehend it with our comprehension. Okay, my battery's running low. Must be time to go.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. That was a good discussion.
It was.